You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic. I'm Cameron Lolana.
And I'm Matt Garasimovich.
And today we're covering part 2, chapter 39 of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate, returning to the camps, or returning to Mostovskoy's time in a bathhouse as he finally makes contact with someone from the outside who gives him some updates on where things stand in the camp. The short version is good if you're if you got appropriate party nost, but not so good if you don't. Is there anywhere here that you'd like to begin?
Yeah, this was a this was a chapter, I would say, to say the least. I think that after we get the Krimov chapter where he's sort of questioning what it means to belong to the party and the role of the party and sort of killing basically plenty of good party members, we have this sort of absolute silliest thing that you can imagine, which is when you are in a death camp with a group of people who are all more or less ostensibly aligned on issues such as we would like to not die, what do they do but rather organize and start to chip away at their fellow comrades? And so this is the chapter where Mostovskoy's underground organization kind of doesn't exactly come to a head, but rather they sort of vote Yershov off the communist island here in this chapter. And Osipov is someone who he's gotten a position job change so that he can work in the bathhouse as an attendant, so he can communicate with Mostovskoy in this really kind of convoluted way. And he tells him about how one of their Czech comrades had sort of slipped his being Yershov's card into a pile of the prisoners who are destined for Buchenwald, and essentially securing his former comrades' execution. And in an interesting and completely seemingly to us unnecessary scene in the chapter, Mostovskoy, he does this, you know, interesting sort of thing where he says, I submit to this decision, I accept it as a member of the party. And he sort of like does this again, as we've been talking about, the sort of performative party member role that he sort of plays in this chapter. And this is a direct almost answer or response or interrogation of the idea of Krimov's chapter from just this previous chapter on why did people confess, why did people do certain things that it makes no sense for them to have done. And yet in this chapter we have Mostovskoy doing this and convicting Yershov, even though he's already been sentenced to death basically by his own friends. He still plays a role in that whole kind of ritual that they have. And it's just a very interesting chapter. It is the culmination of this series of chapters that I find so incredibly interesting, where there should be so little interpersonal drama. You would think that being in a Nazi death camp would galvanize anyone who is not a Nazi. And yet, it doesn't.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. I'm going to go. We had a great conversation with one of our users in Discord, and I will leave most of that to you to cover later on. But there was one idea that they brought up, kind of talking about the idea of when we, you know, let me take this line here. At some point, the liberation that was found in the party became a threat to freedom if you ever question the principles it was founded on. But it seems those principles are pretty shifty, which isn't bad. I think that's just how life is, but it's just a dangerous game to play. I wish there was a way to put a thumb on when that starts happening. It's so progressive, you usually don't catch it until it's too late, especially in cities, because no one thinks in their head. generally, yeah, let's steer this in a more authoritarian direction. And I thought that was a really interesting idea, because as we're talking about this idea, it reminded me of this conversation we had years and years ago now, when we were covering Vladimir Lenin's What Is to Be Done. And the opening of What Is to Be Done is him arguing against this idea known as, freedom of criticism or something like that. And I won't go over his argument in great detail, because it's been about 3 years since I've read that. And I'm sure.
Yeah, we've definitely forgotten. That, but no, go on.
But, and so this for sure is not the first time that idea is articulated, but it is an important work for the Bolshevik Party, right? Where Lenin is criticizing freedom of, he's not saying that the party is never wrong. He's saying the party must always be right in the moment. And that's for Lenin, I think the way we read it is it's really a tactical decision, right? It's we've heard this phrase before in this book. There's no use of a state outside of a state. And when the Bolsheviks are more of an insurgent faction, when they are, you know, prior to the abdication of the Tsar, later on, during the Civil War, it was important not to have like lots of splitting, because if you have lots of minor splits in these minor things, then, you know, your whole organization starts to fall apart pretty rapidly. I mean, if you've ever seen the way a Trotskyist organization, now that splits into about five of them every 10 minutes, they split like they, you know, reproduce asexually. You can see like legitimate reasoning that it's important to keep maybe not morally, this is outside the conversation of morals, but in terms of efficacy, for sure the Bolshevik Party did it best, right? But still this tendency, this tactic, which made them ultimately come out victorious, also maintains to past the point of ridiculousness, right? Here, we not only have these theories maintaining this point, you know, 20 something years onward, you have them being applied in, you know, somewhat inappropriate context, where it was not so much a ideological debate, like, oh, we're approaching this two different ways. It's such that, well, he was a little bit too popular, right? He was not submitting to the, you know, party authority at the center of it all. So we're seeing this one time an effective tactic now starting to become, at the same time, because of this kind of devotion, this kowtowing to dead leaders and this refusal to engage with the living, in a sense, this overapplication of old theories, which, as you say, become ridiculous in the way that they are applied in these new contexts, because they are applied without respect to the environment they're being applied in. This is something I think you can say about Lenin. I think this is a criticism you can lay at some people who are too into Lenin today. Lenin was a great, innovative, and very original thinker. And he did that because he was innovating on what came before. And the problem then becomes a lot of people who came after Lenin aren't all that interested in innovating on Lenin, which is what made Lenin a good original. Well, I'm going to be good is relative. Your opinions may vary on that. Grossman certainly does. What makes Lenin an innovative thinker is the way he did build on those older theories.
Yeah. And I mean, you don't even need to be Marxist-Leninist to understand the allure of what is going on in this chapter. I mean, you could apply it on such a small scale to like a PTA, you know, where you have parents who will gang up in order to, let's say, marginalize a different faction. It's just a matter of a certain bureaucratic tendency in some ways, and that's what's so funny about part of it. I mean, obviously the action of the chapter is not particularly funny, but the application of it can be a little bit comical in some of the modern situations, I would say. And so you have this sort of really interesting debate going on between a few of the characters here, and then at the very end of the chapter we get something to sort of sit on a little bit that's going to be important for tomorrow, I think, which is Ikonnikov, or Holy Fool, who we learn very soon after was executed because he refused to work on the construction of the extermination camp, and he was shot. And there's really no great debate on that. It's sort of treated as a matter of fact. Of course, he was shot. That's pretty much it for him. And that was that. And he still, I think, poses one of the most interesting moral conundrums of this book.
Yeah, in the way that he is completely uncompromised. He drew his line in the sand and he stood there and he died for it. Whereas most of our other characters here, they'll step over line after line after line if it means they stay alive, or if it means they stay in the good graces of the party, or if it means they keep conforming to, their ideology. And well, Ikonikov, he doesn't. He draws that line in the sand and he stays there. And maybe you can, this is where you can start having a conversation of, is it better to do that, or is it better to stay alive and fight the Nazis? I don't know if there's going to be a determination on that, but that is a pretty provocative character to have in context, in contrast to all the rest of these.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly what it is. Is even though there are a lot of really bad things that the Bolsheviks are doing, they are still fighting the Nazis, and they're still probably, the main reason that we beat the Nazis. And so this is, I think, a question that is sort of unanswered. Maybe it's for us to answer ourselves or individually on what the price is, what the cost is for a moral compromise, because what does it look like if we all die for our morals like Ikonikov here? Does it change the outcome if this underground sort of group is never formed? And in this case, maybe it doesn't, but of course there are other groups that do actually do things and are really disruptive. But I'm not sure that that's even the question that Grossman is posing, and we can get to it tomorrow on sort of the, it is it enough to have not done anything, but just for a brief moment under the most extreme circumstances, is it enough to have preserved some level of freedom, some level of individual choice? I don't know. I don't know that everybody reads the situation like that, but I kind of do. In freedom being I'd say a broadly construed term, I don't think anyone would look at most of the characters in this book and say, "Well, what a bastion of freedom! I am envious of their position."
Right.
Right? Of course, that's not the way that we think of
Yeah.
that. But
Yeah.
it gives me great pause, I will say.
It does. It does. It's as we said, as you say, one of the most provocative questions this book has to offer. I was just wondering, you had a great conversation, as we mentioned earlier, with a user in Discord. If there's any kind of standout moments you want to talk about there.
This is actually kind of a long conversation, so I'm not going to repeat it all here. I just wanted to offer my brief a brief thought that I had while we were talking in Discord today, which is on the sort of seductiveness of totalitarian ideology. And I still think it's kind of an unprofound point that I have to make, but it is this sort of time that we exist in now where people think that they are smarter than the Soviet state and they're smarter than authoritarian states, thinking I would never fall into that because I'm so aware of their tactics and all of this stuff. I would never, ever, ever would I, such a smart, educated, whatever person, fall into that. And I think you have to be such an idiot to think that you wouldn't. I think the only smart people are people who really think that they probably would, quite frankly, to have that sort of awareness on actually how I don't know how alluring it can be at times, because this whole book, and I don't need to preach it because if you've read 500 and whatever pages, you understand that this whole book is not about people who are just sort of lapping up top-down edicts and whatnot. It is people who genuinely believe that they are doing the right thing, and what the quote-unquote right thing is so cautiously manipulated at all aspects and every turn. And so it's such an interesting question to me, and I wish that we were able to have broader discussions about it without people just knee-jerk saying like, oh, we don't even need to talk about it because I wouldn't do that. And I don't know how to tell them, like, if that's your real knee-jerk reaction, you actually probably would.
You probably already are deep in.
You probably are,
Every society, frankly, probably since forever, has been knee-deep in its own mythos and its own propaganda about itself. That's just true of life.
Well, yeah, and if all you have to offer when you look at the Soviet Union is saying, I would never do that, that is evil, that is bad, well, I hate to break it to you, well, you've already fallen into it. So, checkmate.
Checkmate, liberals.
Checkmate. Yeah, my chess elo is going way up. How about that? I just checkmated like a fourth of our audience.
And you know,
just kidding. Our audience is geniuses.
Yeah, well, all high elo players on chess.com. But more than
anybody who left us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts is a genius. If you didn't, I don't know what to tell you.
Right. But even more than a question of morality, too, anyone who says that, I think, is Victor Shrum in a way. Not probably equal to the genius, just on average, just statistically speaking. But Victor, for most of this novel, is going to be not a proponent, but someone who is totally okay with the Soviet state. Same with Novikov, same with many other characters who are getting along because their lives are going more or less fine and their career is going fine. And it would be a real shame to derail that right now. It's not even a real fear that drives that. And I think that's something that people don't understand, is it doesn't even have to be a question of right or wrong. It can be a question of, I just, you know, it might look bad to my boss, you know? And that is something that is absolutely preventing you, me, everyone else from doing something that's probably right in our lives. And that's a lot of the Soviet Union too. And people don't, you know, that's another commonality here.
Yeah, well, I think that that's kind of the thing that Ikonnikov illustrates, which is how when you are really embedded in a system and a certain way of thinking, that when you do what is clearly the right thing, the morally correct thing, it makes you look like you're an idiot. And that's why they're called holy fools, you know. It's not because they look like absolute geniuses to everyone around them. And that's something that's just so interesting to me. And I really am glad that we, even though I do slightly die a little inside every night when we record an episode, now that we're like 4.5 months in, I am glad that we've gotten to go into actual depth in these discussions.
Yeah, for sure. Our main two emotions, I think, are it's Jover and, you know, it's never been more back in relation to this series.
Basically, I oscillate between those multiple times a day.
Well, you know, we'll give it a couple more months and we can say we did it. You know, I think this is a good place to wrap it up. I'm sure you can tell by the length of this episode, we'll be covering it more in the big one. If you aren't already in our Discord, would definitely recommend you go check it out to see the conversation that Matt had with Dominique today. They really enjoyed it. And I think that's all we had to cover today.
Yeah, I'm out of here. I got to go write I have to go finish my post about this next chapter that had about approximately 9 lines. So see how I PhD spin this one tomorrow.
Well, you got to solve the mystery of who did it. That's the main one. I look forward to you completing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well, in that case, keep an eye out for that, and we'll hear from us again soon.